All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today. It's a show that I'm really glad we're doing. I'm really glad that we're taking this up now, and I am really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Carl Dix. Carl's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's in Chicago carrying out revolutionary work around the trial of the cop who murdered Laquan McDonald, shooting the young man 16 times as he walked away with his hands to his side. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. Let's jump into this right away. For people who don't know, because as savage as this is, as repellent as this is, what they have done around Laquan McDonald, too few people outside of Chicago actually understand who he is and what happened to him. Give that to people.
Yes. Laquan McDonald was a 17-year-old black man, a youth, who 4 years ago was walking down the street being followed by cops, and he had a 3-inch knife, which he used to puncture a car tire, police car tire, by the way. They followed him for a number of blocks, and then another police car pulled up. There were 3 or 4 cars already following him. Another car pulled up. Jason Van Dyke, a veteran Chicago cop, gets out of the car and within seconds fires 16 shots into Laquan McDonald's body as Laquan is walking away from the police. And 14 of those shots he fired while Laquan lay on the ground bleeding. Laquan dies from this murderous onslaught. And all of this is caught on dash cam video as well as other videos in the area. The police in the city of Chicago carried out more than a year cover-up of those videos. But when mass protests, demands for the video, and finally a court ruling forced them to put the video out in the open, they immediately charged the cop with murder, and he's been on trial these past 3.5 weeks. And in this trial, the illegitimacy of what's been done to Laquan has not only been revealed, but it has been intensified, because you have the video. You have the fact that the city of Chicago covered up the video. Then on top of that, this has been a trial where nothing has been said about Van Dyke's history of abuse complaints, and he's in the top 7% of Chicago cops with the number of police abuse complaints that they have against them. Like, he's near the top of that list. Mm-hmm. That has not come up in court. But what has come up in court is every previous run-in Laquan McDonald had with the law and every problem he had in the Chicago foster care system. All of this, they brought witnesses in to testify to all of this. And they have a law that allows that in Illinois that they call it lynch material. And it has been used to justify the lynching of the modern day lynching of Laquan McDonald.
Now, when you
that's where things go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when you say that this is the modern day lynching, it's important for people to understand, you know, that's not hyperbole. That's the reality of this thing. I mean, it took 4 years to put a cop that everybody knew, everybody saw, everybody knew that he had done this, heinous murder. And it took 4 years, 4 years to put him on trial. And there's this cover up. It was really a very heavy cover up, because although the cop was eventually charged and put on trial, it seems that it was, as you're saying, it was Laquan, the young man who was killed by the cop, was the one being put on trial and subject to character assassination and portraying him as some kind of super demon, which is, you know, something that anybody familiar with the position of black youth in America knows what the hell what's going on with that. You're a super demon and you're targeted for annihilation. You know, and to me, that's a big part of what people have to understand about what's going on in Chicago in relation to this, because it's not like it doesn't play out and influence and do everything else in the rest of this country, feed off of each other, because this is the future that this society is offering to black youth.
Yes, and like you say, it's much bigger than Chicago. I mean, what I have been saying to people is that Laquan McDonald is today's Emmett Till, a case of an outrageous modern-day lynching comparable to that lynching 63 years ago. And the question is, will Chicago become today's Money, Mississippi? because Money Mississippi exonerated the killers of Emmett Till 63 years ago. And one more thing I want to underline from the court case is it came to light in the court case that as Jason Van Dyke and his partner were driving to join in the cops who were trailing Laquan McDonald, Van Dyke said to his partner, "Why haven't they already shot him? And we're going to have to shoot this guy." That was before he got on the scene. And it really does come down to that if they let this cop walk, that would be an illegitimate verdict on top of an illegitimate killing, an illegitimate cover-up, and an illegitimate trial. And I have said to people, if they free this cop, Chicago must stop. That's a message that I've been putting out. The Revolution Club has been spreading through the streets of Chicago, down on the South Side, on college campuses, in front of the courtroom. And it's a message that people need to take up, because a not guilty verdict would be a declaration that Chicago cops, and by extension, this system's cops all across the country, can do anything they want to black and brown people, and nothing will be done about it. Mm-hmm. And this is intolerable, and people should not tolerate the intolerable. People have to stand up and reject this verdict in ways that make it unmistakably clear that we refuse to live in a society where targets are on the backs of black and brown people, targets that the police can do, you know, target shooting at.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want people to really internalize this thing, to understand it as hard as they can, all right, to really fight to actually get an understanding of what the hell we're talking about happened here, because it's so outrageous. And, you know, the whole thing was caught on video. So actually it should be clear just by anybody who has two eyes to see, or even if you only have one eye to see, you know, it should be clear to everyone what the hell went on. But the powers in Chicago did everything they could to actually prevent this from ever being known.
No, exactly. And part of it was that all of the cops on the scene submitted lying reports. Those lying reports then got picked up by the media and spread by the media, even though not only the police, but into the upper reaches of the city government, it was known that all of this was a lie, because they had the video. And they had that video. They came to a settlement with the family before the family even filed a civil suit around it to try to push this aside. Were it not for the mass resistance that developed even before the video got out, none of this would have made it to the light of day. But now it's in the light of day. And the cop's defense, it's like unbelievable hypocrisy. The cop gets on the stand and says, "This video does not show my perspective." And the whole thing is there, Laquan walking away from the cops, the cop pulling up, within seconds, starting to shooting him while he lays on the ground, bleeding to death. And he says, "This doesn't fit my perspective." And that gets raised as a legitimate legal argument that it's going to be tough to figure out whether it sticks or not. And this really does come down to, well, we can do anything. It can be caught. We can get caught doing anything, and it doesn't matter. We still have a green light to brutalize and even murder you, and you can do nothing about it. And it is very important that people not accept this, that people not be intimidated by the talk of cops being flooded in the street, people not be hemmed in and suppressed by the Keep It Quiet brigade that the city is gathering up among responsible Negro leaders, ex-cops, and others who are saying, "Don't do this. It would look bad if we tore up our city." And see, this ain't our city. This is not the city of the masses. This is like a prison warden telling the prisoners, "Hey, don't mess up our prison," or a plantation owner telling the enslaved people, "Don't do anything that would mess up our plantation." This is the place where people are subjected, especially black and brown people, are subjected to miserable conditions. It's already torn up by the segregation, by the police terror, by the inequality and all the rest. And if this verdict comes down, it would be a signal that those conditions are going to be more tightly enforced and people have to accept it.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, man. Here's a couple of these things that I wanted to talk to you about, because I did want people to get a sense of this, too, is that, like, when you're thinking about this, you know, people think about, okay, Chicago, man, you know, Chicago, all that, this kind of thing is like, you know, no, really, that can't be there for a lot of people that don't live there. And then you look at what's happened. The whole way that this thing was just pounded in, as you've been explaining, including the fact that, actually, surprise, surprise, only one black juror. I guess there weren't enough black people.
Yeah.
There weren't enough black people in Chicago to get another black juror. Eyewitnesses were told eyewitnesses to the murder, that these two Latino brothers that saw the thing go down, they were told to leave the scene by the cops, disappear into the woodwork. And the only reason we even know about them is because they couldn't live with themselves by doing that. So they stood up and said, hey, we saw the thing. It's a very heavy thing in terms of what you're looking at, in terms of both how black people are treated today. In Chicago, a concentration of it, but around the entire country, the way that this is being just pushed in and gathered out, and this is the kind of treatment that is an essential part of the whole fascist regime that is in power right now. You think about what this means. It's astounding, and it really makes me angry.
Yeah, and a thing to take note of is that Jeff Sessions has been to Chicago, including once in recent days, to bring the word that the cops in Chicago, and by extension everywhere else in this country, do not have to worry about the feds getting in their way as they do their job, which comes down to inflicting brutality, murder, and terror on oppressed people. And this case is an indication for where things could go in even intensifying what I have already called as a slow genocide directed at black and Latino people, spearheaded by police terror and mass incarceration, an intensification of that, because a slow genocide can be sped up and become a fast one.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. You know, and I'm thinking about this, and again, I'm thinking, you know, you're talking about all these things that happened, and that there was this whole public opinion machinery that the system sent into full effect. Yes, Sessions, Trump commenting on all this stuff. The fact that they were saving this, it wasn't just that they did it, like, you know, the reason for it was to save this cop's butt, while the cop, you know, and while his long record of violent assaults against the people, especially black people, was kept out of the courtroom. You know, he has all this stuff. This cop does have a long record of violence against the people. And it was like, it was more a question of, you know, actually, Laquan was the person that had troubles. He had mental troubles. He was always getting in trouble. He was a danger to society and all this stuff. Meanwhile, these murderous cops, these murderous pigs were sitting in there and doing this. And that's the stuff that's being withheld from people. And it was so important that people got a chance to do that. Go ahead.
See, and this is important to actually look at how this went down. At the beginning of the case, the judge told the prosecution they could not talk about his background and his history as a cop, because that was not yet an issue in court. And the way it was laid out was that could only become an issue if the cop took the stand. The cop took the stand, talked about what a nice cop he had always been, how he had never fired his weapon until that night, which opened up the thing of his history as a cop. And they could have gone at it, and the prosecution chose not to bring any of that in. Not a bit of it. So as far as the record of evidence in the court goes, the only thing said about his background was his thing about, I was such a nice cop, I get along with the people that I was policing. And this is an indication that we're up against the system here. It's not just bad cops or anything like that. Like Bob Avakian has said, the police, the prosecutors forget how to prosecute when the defendant is a cop being charged with brutalizing and murdering the oppressed people. Prosecutors just forget how to do it. And it's like they lost their memory of what, you know, what the law is about and what they're supposed to do. But it's not that they lost their memory. They know what their job is. They know what the system is trying to accomplish here. And it was really being laid out. And that's why it's very important that people not passively accept this verdict. And then there's another thing that's really important, because one thing, like I said, I've been out with the Revolution Club on the South Side. We've been talking to masses of people, masses of black people, masses of Latino people in other parts of the city. And there's a lot of hatred for what the police get away with doing and a lot of feeling that it would be illegitimate if this cop walked. But then there's a question of, will protests do any good? And people cite the fact that there has been protest around police terror, and it still continues to happen. And the thing is, we have to say two things. We have to, and we do say two things to that. One is, yes, but we still have to stand up. We still have to refuse to accept this, because if we accept this passively, we can be crushed. But then the other thing we have to say is that, you're right, protest alone is not going to do that. It has to be protest as part of getting ready and in position to do what's actually needed to end this once and for all. And that's an actual revolution, one that unleashes and leads millions of people in rising up to meet and defeat the institutions of violence, oppression of the system, and goes on to build a totally different and far better system. And that people who want to be a part of that need to get with the Revolution Club. They need to get with the leadership that we have for this revolution. They need to check out Bob Avakian and his writings, what he's brought forward, both on the question of police terror, but on his new synthesis, new understanding of communist revolution and communism. And we're showing the trailer of the film, and the Revolution Club is doing showing of the whole film, the new film of his talk, why we need an actual revolution, and how we can really make revolution at their organizing center, even as they are spending a lot of time out in the neighborhood organizing people. Because a lot of the people that we meet want to actually check that out. They want to see what he has to say about why we need revolution, but also how we could make it.
All right, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And basically, we'll
Let me get in.
Yeah.
What people need to pay close attention to, the website revcom.us, because it is carrying about daily coverage on what's happening here in Chicago. And I also recommend that they follow, well, they can follow me at Carl_Dix on Twitter, and that they also follow the Chicago Revolution Club at RevClubShy on social media as well, because things hit there sometimes before they even make it to RevCom.
And people should know that shy is not S-H-Y, but C-H-I, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
You got it.
All right, Carl. That was going to be my last question. So I really want to thank you, and we'll stay in touch, man. Keep us posted on this, all right?
All right.
All right, Carl. Thanks a lot, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we were just talking with Carl Dix. Carl Dix was talking with us about a really heinous crime that's being committed in Chicago right now against people everywhere, against oppressed people and people everywhere who can't stand this system and the way it's set up, right? And Carl's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's in Chicago carrying out revolutionary work around the trial of a cop who murdered Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old young man, young black man. He shot him 16 times as he walked away with his hands to his side. Now, the jury came in with the guilty verdict just about an hour after we did this interview. And following the conviction, Carl Dix wrote, "We finally got a little bit of justice. We forced a conviction of a cop for murdering a black person. People are right to celebrate this. And the pigs have no right to suppress them or take vengeance against them when they do." He also called for people in Chicago and everywhere to get with the revolution. And in that spirit, I want to remind everyone of an important date. October 19th is the online premiere of the film of a speech by Bob Avakian, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. So you can check the social media links Carl mentioned, which I will also make sure are posted on my Facebook page, and go to revcom.us for more on the film, the premiere, and find out ways to join the movement to spread word of this film everywhere. So here's the trailer for the film, which you can access from revcom.us.
Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? white supremacy, male supremacy, wars of empire, the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants, the destruction of the planet. Why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same, or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk. Revolution is possible, and we have to go to work to make it real.
All right, that was the trailer from the film of a speech by Bob Avakian, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And that's going to be premiering online on October 19th. Don't miss it. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Especially where we from, where we grew up like a green thumbs, like a criminal, the only thing you can become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? Feel it in my bones and I'm sitting on the throne like a killer with the chrome. When I'm spitting out the poem, shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam. Thought I was MIA, no paper planes. I'm flying, plus I don't write no more. But sort of from the top, I shaved the brain to stay sharp. Man, I knew how to raise a blade. I paid my dues, now I wait for change. Look at the flow so rude, it goes without us. Loupe, I'm so clear, you ate the brakes. Quick to cut off any baggage like some samurai. I like to travel light.
All right, that was Lupe Fiasco with Break the Chain. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Louise Comfort. Louise is a professor and director of the Center for Disaster Management at the University of Pittsburgh, who has led the U.S. participation in developing the kind of system, a well-designed sensor network capable of providing critical information that could help save countless lives in the face of a tsunami. As it stands now, 1,948 people are known to be dead in the tsunami that rocked the island of Sulawesi and the town of Palu, and it could be as high as 5,000 people in some other areas. Louise, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and I do have to make one correction. I actually stepped down as director of the Center for Disaster Management a year ago, but I'm still the principal investigator of this project, and we were trying very, very hard to complete it and have it made available for use in early tsunami warnings.
Okay. Well, explain to people what actually happened with this tsunami, and what is it that makes Indonesia's tsunamis so deadly?
Well, the critical tsunamis are the ones that are called near field by the seismologists, and these are tsunamis that are generated by either undersea earthquakes or undersea landslides. This was a particularly interesting earthquake and tsunami because the earthquake was actually on shore. The epicenter was on shore. But apparently, it dislocated a large pile of earth under the island that created an undersea landslide that generated the tsunami. So these are the kinds of things that seismologists honestly find it very difficult to identify before they happen. But in an archipelago like Indonesia with lots of islands, it's quite likely.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us this, you know, because a lot of people actually, someone was pointing out to me earlier that a lot of people actually don't even know what a tsunami is. Maybe we should start off with that, what a tsunami is and how it's different than regular ocean waves.
Well, a tsunami is generated by either an undersea earthquake or an undersea landslide. And what it is essentially the ocean floor ruptures and part of the floor moves up and the other part drops down. And it's this massive rupture in the ocean floor that displaces a huge volume of water that creates the waves that wash against shore. So this is a phenomenon that we've seen, you know, multiple times. It's also very difficult to predict. And about the best one can do is to create a reliable monitoring system in areas of known earthquake faults and known likely subsidence.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I kept thinking about as I was looking into this is there's a question that faces a lot of people, you know, and I remember I go back to the 2004 tsunami and all the promises to investigate why this kind of death and destruction happened and the promises to do what's necessary in the face of future tsunamis, especially in developing and deploying early warning systems. You know, it seems like it's really hard to see what's been going on, what's been done in relation to that. And I'd ask you, actually, what actually has been done?
Well, in fact, after the 2004 tsunami, Indonesia as a nation made a major investment in early tsunami detection and warning. They selected six principal cities that they determined were at risk and developed a program of community education so people would become aware of tsunamis. They also, and this was a very important investment, they invested heavily in a land-based seismic network that identifies the earthquakes. This is, you know, like our California network that runs the length of the states. So these networks are, they're basically seismometers that detect the epicenter and the magnitude of the earthquake. And these work very well. But the difficulty is the tsunamis are generated by this undersea rupture of the ocean floor, and that's very difficult to detect. It's a hard problem. And what the standard method had been to use surface buoys, and Indonesia, with support from Germany and the U.S., in fact, developed a fleet of 22 surface buoys. But these buoys are very effective when they're located in the open ocean 500 miles from shore. Out there, they miss the near-field tsunamis. Indonesia moved them closer to shore where they could pick up and detect the ocean waves, but they were vandalized and therefore were not operational. So BPPT, their marine survey system, essentially canceled that tsunami program. The project that we were working on was really to replace that measure and to use undersea network that was anchored to the ocean floor out of reach from the ship channels and also could not be vandalized. And this was what was not implemented in place.
So I'm trying to understand this a little bit more. What the government has done then, you know, it seemed to me that actually what the Indonesian government has done has been mainly to concentrate on post-quake relief and only minimal attention to pre-disaster anticipation. I'm sort of getting that from all these things that I read where actually the very struggle that was going on, it seemed, within the government of over how to do this or what needs to be done. And I mean, just the things that you're talking about, how people basically sort of shut down around this and things have gotten to only a certain point and then just weren't even paid attention to after a while. It was sort of like, it seemed almost, and I know this might be considered a little cynical, but it seemed like it was like sort of, well, we did what we had to do in the wake of that big tsunami 10 years ago or, you know, whatever it is back in that 2004.
Actually 14
years
ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
almost
14, I was never that good in math. That's the only thing I can say. But, you know, you're looking at this as sort of what happened, what was indicated there, and then what happened to what actually was, you know, it was put up. It seems like there was a real sort of quick do this and then forget about it.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's human nature. People look at what's the most urgent priority at the time. Indonesia, as a developing country, has lots of priorities. They focused on infrastructure, building roads and bridges to keep their economy moving and society fleeing. And it had been, you know, 10, 12, 13, 14 years since the last tsunami. And so, you know, it's a question of priorities. As a developing nation, they can't do everything at once. And the ironic part for me is this was to be a joint project, an international collaboration between the U.S. and Indonesia. And the design of the prototype was developed. It was literally the last stage, the installation, that required a 4 kilometers of cable and the installation that had been postponed for 2 years. Now, they said they still wanted to do it. They just did not expect the tsunami to come on September 28th.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Louise Comfort. And Dr. Comfort has led the U.S. participation in developing the kind of system, a well-designed sensor network capable of providing critical information that could help and save countless lives. As it stands now, 1,948 people are known dead, and the toll could be as high as 5,000 in areas of Indonesia. Yeah, but what happens then? I mean, this is sort of the thing that, because it's not just on the government there. It's actually, you're looking at all of the other powers in the world. And the question of, you know, people who have, I mean, look, you know, tsunamis do not seem to have the same kind of impact in Indonesia as they do in the U.S., the borders of the U.S., as in Japan. I mean, you know, you had that really big one in Japan, but generally, this is not the same kind of question in terms of life and death, constant thing that you have to pay attention to. And I'm kind of curious about that.
Well, I do think tsunamis are a global problem, and it's a problem that affects not only Indonesia, but all 12 nations in that Indian Ocean basin were affected by the 2004 tsunami. So Thailand, Sri Lanka, India, Malaysia, all are affected by it, and, you know, Kenya across the Indian Ocean as well. And as you noted, of course they occur in other countries as well. Chile had a tsunami in 2010 that killed 534 people. Japan, again, almost 2,000 people, 1,800. And so it's a major, major problem, and I totally agree. I think it requires an international collaboration to keep the focus and monitor these ocean basins so we can understand the movement of the tectonic plates and the likely location and timing of the next tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
They will come again. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were just referring to the project that you had been working on, and I wanted to ask you this in relation to that, because there are very advanced and efficient early warning systems in the world. I mean, actually, Hawaii and Japan do have those things. But why not in a place like Indonesia? What's standing in the way?
Well, it's a combination. You need all three. You need the science, you need the technology, and you need the will to act and to put it in place. And Hawaii and Alaska are protected essentially by these deep ocean buoys. And it's the location that enables them to identify where the tsunamis will come. Now, it's a difficult problem. It's a hard problem. The difficulty with Indonesia is it's an archipelago. It's 17,000 islands and counting. And so, you know, many of its cities are coastal cities. So there's a much greater exposure at Indonesia to this kind of tsunami risk. Padang, the west coast of Sumatra, is exposed. Jakarta, Mataram, major coastal cities in Indonesia are exposed. And in fact, I don't think Indonesia can protect it alone. I think it's a global problem, and other nations of the world that have science and technology should contribute to this monitoring program.
Do you see that developing? I mean, I'm kind of curious because there's, you know, looking at this, even looking at the immediate response to the tsunami now, but even in general, in terms of putting up the kind of, developing the kind of system that, for instance, Hawaii, Japan, these other places that they have, what would really be holding it back? Is it money that limits the possibility of actually, is it really a question of putting the cost ahead of the survival of, I mean, tons of people? Because you're talking about a country, you're talking about an area that is actually, I mean, even I wanted to ask you about in a minute, so you don't have to answer this right away, but this ring of fire is actually kind of determines, gives you a good sense of that sort of the intensity of what's happening in the oceans around there.
Well, I think that's true. What is also true is it's a very complex, interdependent problem. And in this instance, even within Indonesia, multiple agencies need to work together. And this is difficult for agencies to do. They each have their own separate budgets. They each have their own deadlines. They have to meet those deadlines and follow the budgetary regulations. So officials are worried about meeting their particular requirements, and developing an interagency collaboration, especially an international collaboration, is hard for them to do. And I'm sorry to say, it takes an event like this to emphasize the importance and the need to do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said that, again, like, but I'm just still trying to dig into this a little bit because it's, you know, you're looking at all the various places in the world and this ring of fire, which kind of determines or describes the area that encompasses, you know, Indonesia and other parts of that part of the world. You know, it just seems like there's something else that, I don't know, it's like you would think that the kind of data that you have for Hawaii and Japan and other places in the world, that would actually be able to play over into, from this system, it's important in determining tsunamis. What it would seem to be important to look at what it does and how would it have made a difference? How would it have made, in your eyes, would it have made a real difference if actually that had been done?
Yes, I think it would. One of the critical aspects of detecting tsunamis is to be able to get measurement of the change in the water column that in essentially near real time. If we have those measurements, it's still only going to be 15 minutes maybe or 20 minutes. But in 15 or 20 minutes, you can do a lot in terms of evacuating a city if you have plans in place. But the important thing is it's not just the measurement under the sea. It's also the organization and the communication on land to enable people to have the information about where to go, which streets are open, where not to go, where the fires are, where the debris in the street is. And the other part of this project that we were working on was an undersea network that would pick up the change in the water column, communicate it to via underwater communication, acoustic communication, to a shore station, via satellite, to BMKG, their scientific organization, but then communicate it, and the MKG communicates to the provincial and city networks, but then the communication needs to go to the neighborhoods. And in any kind of earthquake, the first thing that goes down is electrical power. The cell towers were down, so we were also working on an electronic ad hoc network that essentially created a hotspot, a movable hotspot, with connections via small electronic devices to the satellite overhead that would operate in a disaster-degraded environment. So it needs two networks, the undersea network to actually identify the change in the water column and the likely tsunami that is coming, and then the, you know, community-based network that is able to create a network of communication within the neighborhood. So neighbor to neighbor, you know, literally like the home alert system in the U.S., could enable people to take very rapid, informed action and get out of the way.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was doing some research earlier, and one of the things I came across is that there was a point that was made that in terms of the project that you're working on, that actually what all it would take to actually finish this now is $69 million. That's not a huge sum today in relation to all this. What actually, what's holding it back? What's the problem? Why couldn't that have been pushed forward?
This was the difficulty. This was a heartbreak, is that there are three agencies involved. Each has a key part of the knowledge and skill and technique to do this project. They all have to work together, but they were operating on different schedules. And so they essentially just said, we can't do it. But one agency had the money and had to spend it by the end of the year. Another agency had the engineering skills and said, we can't do it until February. The other agency said, we've got the scientific knowledge and we can do it, but we want it deployed and tested first. So all three agencies have to work together and they have to agree on a schedule and the resources and the funding to get it done. Now, the U.S., again, this was the Indonesian side. The U.S. side had been planned, designed for literally virtually ready to go. Funding was there, and we were waiting for their collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Well, what difference would it make if the system, again, I just want to hit back on this because I don't know if people actually really understand this. What difference would it have made if the system that you're designing was deployed, you know, for example, in Padang, and why hasn't it been? Let's just hit that.
Well, they would have had the data on the shift in the water column in near real time. And then that information could have been communicated to BMKG. And they did issue a warning when they first heard the earthquake, but then they recalled the warning because they did not have the data. It wasn't that, you know, using the data they had, they had data from the surface of the ocean. And these undersea landslides, you get a very tiny movement in the surface that you can see. So they were missing the undersea data.
Wow. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Louise Comfort. And Dr. Comfort has led the U.S. participation in developing the kind of system, a well-designed sensor network capable of providing critical information that could help and save countless lives. As it stands now, 1,948 people are known dead, and the toll could be as high as 5,000 in areas of Indonesia. That's, you know, because I keep thinking about this and in relation to all the things, you know, again, it's hard for me at times to separate, you know, like I told you, I had been in Sri Lanka after the tsunami back in early 2005, the 2004 one, but, you know, I was there in early 2005.
Right.
And, you know, seeing what I saw and the kind of suffering that people talked about having and the kind of, they there anyway were, people really felt that they had been totally disregarded, ignored by the government there and by actually Western, you know, powers and everything else in relation to that, that people were pretty much left to fend for themselves. And I was kind of curious about this in relation to this situation now.
Well, you know, regrettably, there's always a decline in the level of awareness after a major event. Immediately after the event, everyone thinks we need to do something now. But then 1 year goes by, 2 years go by, 3 years, etc. And other priorities come forward. And I'm sorry to say, I'm afraid this is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this then. What difference, again, we'll revisit this, what difference would it actually have made if the system that you were designing was deployed?
Well, I believe we could have gained at least 10 to 15 minutes in warning time. And had that warning come to a community that did have community preparedness training and did have, and this is, again, the other part of it, they need communication on land to be able to communicate neighborhood by neighborhood. This bridge is out. You saw the photographs of the bridge that was collapsed. You know, you can't go that way. You know, the shelter is this way. And to enable people to find safe locations after the earthquake. The difficult part is the earthquake is going to come first, and it will shatter the buildings. Buildings will collapse. Streets will be blocked, and there will be electrical wires on the ground, sparking possibly fires, etc. It's a dangerous environment for people to evacuate in. So they need a second network, a community-based network, to enable people to evacuate safely, take informed action. And part of that is the responsibility of people who live in these communities to recognize the risk, be aware of the risk, take the steps that they need to know, develop plans for how to get out of town safely or shelters. But it's a major, major risk that coastal cities need to be aware of. And while some work had been done in Palau, there had been a tsunami assessment that was done, but it needs, you know, it's an all-out effort. It's not just the government. It's business organizations. It's nonprofit organizations. It's schools. It's universities. It's the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think, an international problem. Indonesia really can't do this alone. I think it's a major effort, will require a major effort by all member nations of the UN.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, is that there's, you know, as I was researching around this, I kept thinking about there's a problem. If an earthquake hits too close to shore, it's not going to be detected by deep sea sensors, and the tsunami can arrive before major evacuations can happen. It seems like some of that is what happened recently. So what about the role of simple things here, sirens to warn people, the stuff that you've been talking about?
Well, most of the, you know, the ironic part is most of the sirens are powered by electricity. When the earthquake strikes, the electricity goes out, so the sirens don't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is it really not possible to develop a usable warning system for a place like this? Is it really the case that
yes,
the only solution
can.
Is run for the hills?
No. There are solutions. But you really have to be able to link to the satellites in the sky to provide communication. The satellites are up there. They're not going anywhere. The ocean waves aren't going to reach them. They are there. And this is an age where the technology now exists. We know how to do this. We just have to make the commitment and put the pieces in place to get that done.
Mm-hmm.
And this, well, you know, our project was just a prototype. I don't want to claim more for it than it is. But what we were doing is testing the linkage, the technology that would provide these kinds of linkages to the government organizations and the community organizations that would enable people to take informed action.
Mm-hmm. And just once again, what was it that actually held back on that front?
Well, I'm sorry to say, the three Indonesian agencies that needed to work together could not agree on a way forward. And so they simply postponed, put the project on hold for another year. And at that point, our funding, our National Science Foundation funding, runs out.
Well, let me ask you this. As we were talking about it, I was just thinking about this, that there's a, you know, the need for this to actually occur, the need for this to actually happen is really incredibly important, because we're talking about,
I agree.
You know, we're talking about human lives, and we're talking about the whole, you know, when you're looking at the places that are affected by this around the world, it's really, you know, it's not acceptable that in this day and age that this is the kind of stuff that people have to actually, you know, you're always going to have natural disasters, but the fact you don't really have to die in such huge numbers or suffer so much in relation to it. And if you could build the system that you think is needed today, what would it be?
It would be a system that would look a whole lot like this prototype that we've designed and are ready to test. It would require undersea sensors, an undersea sensor network, which works very nicely in Indonesia because of the warm equatorial waters extend acoustic communication. But it is the collaboration between not only the Indonesian agencies, but between the Indonesian public agencies, the researchers, private corporations, and in this case, U.S. researchers to, you know, design and test this. Ours is just a prototype. To put it actually in place would require the acceptance or buy-in by a major company. And again, that could be collaborative. It could be Indonesian and U.S., but a commitment to put this in place.
What do you think right now, if you're looking at it, sitting here, we're talking, what do you think is the actual main impediment?
The action for me is to install this prototype, test it, make certain it works. Then the next step would be a major installation, and we had designed our prototype for the Mentawai Sea in West Sumatra, and it would be right across from the city of Padang, a city of 1 million people. And to have a working international ocean observatory that can monitor and study the genesis of tsunamis, and that knowledge could be used for other coastal cities in Indonesia, but other coastal cities around the world.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to keep coming back to this. What do you think it's going to take to get that done? Because it's not a, it doesn't look real optimistic there.
Well, I'm forever an optimist. I think people have looked at this. There is a possibility, an Indonesian firm is interested in it. There is a possibility that the Indonesian agencies will. I think if we have support from other countries, India, Thailand, European Union, U.S., all could contribute. But the important thing is to do it now, get it started, get it in place.
You know,
and do the prototype testing first.
Mm-hmm. You know, one, and I keep coming back to this, I know, but I just got to really, it's really eating at me. You know, this fact that we had this tsunami in 2004, and there was a lot of effort put into it. And as you've pointed out in some of the writing you've done, that actually, you know, there was the things that happened in the wake of that is that over the years, everything just fell to hell. You know, things don't work anymore. They're rusted out. They're being used as buoys. They're whatever. You know, all these kinds of things are happening. When I was reading about it, I kept thinking, I don't want to see somebody blaming the people that live there. But there's actually the system that runs these things, the system that actually runs these things.
Well, you know, in fact, Indonesia, their marine survey agency, BPPT, made a considered decision not to invest in those 22 ocean buoys for a good reason. They had, in fact, repaired them repeatedly, and each time it's more expensive, and each time they were vandalized again. So they just decided that's not a good strategy. What we were proposing is an alternative strategy that would work. The sensors would be anchored to the ocean floor. They could not be vandalized, and they would be particularly effective. Effective in Indonesia because of the thermocline layer. And it's getting the will to get that done and tested and to keep that investment going.
Mm-hmm. I have just two more questions. One is, it's just bugging me because I want to know this, but what is the ring of fire? I keep trying to understand what exactly
is
that?
The ring of fire, actually, it's a circle of tectonic plates. It shows how the tectonic plates are shifting. And it actually begins in Alaska, and it runs all down the coasts of America, you know, Anchorage through British Columbia to Vancouver to Seattle to San Francisco to Los Angeles, through Central America, down to Quito and Ecuador, down to Chile, and then it cuts across the Pacific to New Zealand, and from New Zealand up north to Indonesia, and from Indonesia across India to China to Japan and back to Alaska. So it's the circle that shows the movement of these tectonic plates that are shifting and dipping under one another and over one another that generate the earthquakes. Mm-hmm. It's the most seismic zone in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is the last question. Tsunamis and earthquakes can't be eliminated by early warning systems, but horrible consequences of not doing this are not necessary and can be eliminated. What do you say to that?
Right, right. You know, the heartbreak to me is I think we've got the science. I think we've got the technology. What we have to muster is the will to action.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. That was Louise Comfort, professor of public and international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh and former director of the Center for Disaster Management. She is leading the participation of U.S. scientists in the effort to develop the kind of system that can give early warnings of tsunamis and save thousands of lives. As I said earlier, the interview is from a few days ago. The death toll in Indonesia is now over 2,000, but it looks like it will be over three times that number. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my guests, Louise Comfort and Carl Dix, and all the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Numbered Days from Ross Michael. Talk to you again next week.